From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will there be wild cards this weekend? Oh, yes, I think we shall be dealt several ahead on Only a Game, sorting out the first round of the NFL playoffs. Also, Tanith Belbin and Ben Augusto, America's top ice dancing duo, prepare for what they hope will be a gold medal performance in Vancouver. Also ahead, the story of Iraqi skeleton sledder Faisal Ghazi Faisal, currently attempting to qualify for the Olympics after failing to do so in 2006.
I said at the time I wanted to fight for my country, and I explained that there was a war going on. There was nothing that I felt that I could do, and so I had to fight in a positive way.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Only the New England Patriots and the Baltimore Ravens will face new opponents when they meet in the first week of pro football's playoffs. The NFL's six other wild card weekend teams will be playing repeats of last week's games. While the Bengals and the Cardinals will try to avoid reliving last week's losses to the Jets and the Packers, the Dallas Cowboys will be hoping to escape deja vu of another kind. After shutting out the Eagles at home last weekend, the Cowboys are trying to earn their first postseason victory since 1996. Joining me now on the line is Todd Archer, a columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The Cowboys won three Super Bowls in 4 years back in the 90s, and then there was a lot of frustration for a long time. Is it fair to say that folks in Dallas are anxious for a victory tonight?
Oh, absolutely. This is a fan base that believes it's their birthright that the Cowboys win Super Bowls. going back to, you know, Roger Staubach delivering two in the 70s and Troy Aikman delivering three in the 90s, and they don't know what to do with themselves when they've lived through such misery here since 1996. And they're still the Cowboys. They're always relevant. But, you know, when the Cowboys aren't on the national stage, I think people here are a little upset.
Well, this may be a bit of a stretch, but if the meteorologists have anything to say about it, this should be a piece of cake, this game. Dallas last won a playoff game in 1996. This weekend, Dallas is expecting a batch of cold weather that should match record-setting low temperatures set in, wait for it, 1996. This can't be a coincidence, right? It must mean good things for the Cowboys.
Maybe Jerry Jones will leave the roof open in the new stadium and then and open the doors as well, just so he can have a nice little cool breeze coming through there. And although, you know, Philadelphia might be used to the cold weather as well, so I don't know if maybe they want to keep everything closed and play at the nice 72-degree temperature they have inside there.
Quarterback Tony Romo has been saddled with the less-than-flattering moniker Mr. November. That works okay for baseball, not so good for football. This is because of his ability to win games when they don't count and his propensity to choke in the playoffs. But this year, he managed to keep his winning ways going through December and even into early January. Has he turned things around?
I think he has, and I think it's just a product of him seeing more and playing more and experiencing more. I just think he's played better, and he's realized when to take the chance, when not to take the chance. You know, what's one thing Bill Parcells told him when he left here in 2006 was, you don't always have to do it yourself. I think it took him a while to realize that, and he's maintained his playmaking ability while just being smarter, and I think that comes from just more experience. It took Peyton Manning a while to win a playoff game, too.
Well, I'm not surprised that you are saying nice things about Tony Romo, because I can't help but notice that in your recent columns, you've been very complimentary of him. Did he, I don't know, help you change a tire, maybe paint your house or something?
No, he has not done that yet, unfortunately. He's done a few things for people like that. He took a homeless guy to a movie a couple of years ago. He changed a tire after a road game, in which it was after the season opener, that one as well, and he has 13 stitches in his chin, and he just got off the plane back from Cleveland. So, I might have to ask him why he hasn't done anything nice for me.
The Cowboys have gone through five coaches since their last playoff win and six starting quarterbacks since Troy Aikman retired after the 2000 season. Have they finally got it right? Have we got stability finally in Dallas?
Oh, we'll see. You know, Wade Phillips, he's yet to win a playoff game. We talk about Tony Romo, but, you know, he's 0-4. He needs to win this game for himself to help Jerry Jones feel even better about picking up the option year in his contract. And they're in a better situation than they've been in. I think when Wade took over for Parcells, he took over a team that was ready to win some. And it just, some things happened, you know, Terrell Owens, all that sort of stuff, where nothing seemed like a good fit last year, where this year I think guys enjoy playing with each other, enjoy being around each other, and have this confidence going based on this three-game winning streak they carry into the playoffs.
The owner of the Cowboys, Jerry Jones, has taken responsibility for the team's dark days during the past 13 years. He's also taken responsibility for their success back in the early 90s. How much does the Cowboys' fate rest on the decisions of that hands-on owner?
Sure, he's the general manager. He's making the calls on all these things, and he says he made the calls when Jimmy Johnson was here as well. There are other people who say otherwise that have been here longer than I have. But, you know, this is Jerry's team, and it's always going to be Jerry's team. He makes the final calls. He listens to a lot of people. He played the game. He won a national championship at Arkansas. It bothers him that people don't consider him a football guy when he's been doing this for 21 years now. But nothing's going to change here as long as he's around. It's going to be Jerry making the final call just the way it's happened in places before with Paul Brown and Al Davis and all, you know, guys like that.
We all know that insulting an NFL team can be the quickest way to inspire that team to perform at their best. So what was Eagles employee David Spadaro thinking last week when he spit twice on the star at the middle of the Cowboys stadium and then posted the video on YouTube for the world to see?
I did not grow up here, so I wasn't familiar with all the Cowboys history, but I quickly learned that the star is some sacred place. And when they opened the stadium in September, they had it covered, and they had this big, elaborate pregame deal to unveil it, and fireworks, and all this, that, and the other. And it's the wailing wall, I guess, for the people here in Dallas that don't do anything to it. You saw what happened when Terrell Owens danced on the star when he played against played for San Francisco. Emmitt Smith came out, defended it. George Teague knocked him down. There's few things that you want to mess with here in Texas, I guess.
Dallas has beaten Philly twice this season, including a 24-0 drumming last week, but still the Cowboys are only a slight favorite, according to the experts, to win tonight. Are said experts not giving Dallas its due?
I think they're banking on the history that we've talked about, and they're banking on Philadelphia's history as well. Andy Reid's never lost a first playoff game, be it a wild card or a divisional round. This is the team that went to the NFC Championship game last year. So I think they're giving the Eagles as much credit as they are trying to take some things away from the Cowboys just because of no playoff win since 96, Tony Romo 0-2, Wade Phillips 0-4. I think those guys want to see the Cowboys do it before they can completely believe as well.
Todd Archer writes about the Cowboys for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Iraq has never sent an athlete to the Winter Olympics, but once again this year, an Iraqi expatriate named Faisal Ghazi Faisal is fighting to win a berth at next month's Vancouver Games in the sport of skeleton sled racing. As North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports, Faisal remains determined despite turmoil in his homeland.
When I first met Faisal in 2005, he was a young guy, stocky and athletic in his mid-20s. Still kind of trying to define himself. He was one part media darling, one part athlete, and one part activist.
Because this is for Iraq, it's not for me.
After one big race that year in Lake Placid, New York, Faisal draped himself in the Iraqi flag. He had been taken under the wing of coaches with the U.S. sled program. With reporters and TV cameras scrutinizing his every move, Faisal scrambled to figure out how to pilot a serving platter-sized sled, flying headfirst down a corkscrew of ice.
At the beginning, you hit the walls with your shoulders and you get ice burns, and it's quite rough, and especially when you're going down 70 miles an hour when you still don't know how to control the sled.
Faisal's quest fell short. He just wasn't experienced or fast enough. February 2006, Faisal's friends headed off to Torino, Italy for the opening ceremonies. Faisal headed back to Baghdad, just as his country was erupting in another round of bloodshed. Just as the Winter Games were getting underway, insurgents detonated a massive bomb at the Golden Mosque in Samarra, Iraq, triggering a fresh round of sectarian killings. Dr. Salam Ismail described the chaos in an interview with NPR.
the people in the morgue, they are saying that they are receiving almost about 50 bodies every day. People, innocent, they are just in their houses, have been taken out, have been assassinated from short distance, bullets in their heads, in their chest. It's really scary.
Sitting in his parents' living room, Faisal watched on satellite TV, switching channels between his fading Olympic dream and the reality of life in Iraq.
I mean, I wasn't able to leave home. I was there for 2 weeks. I wasn't able to get to the front door. It was so bad. I couldn't go see my friends. I couldn't. My dad warned me. He said, I'm telling you, you shouldn't come right now. You're not going to like it. I thought, you know, a big deal, like, you know, security situation, bombs, like, it's, you know, it's no big deal. I'll still go there. But it wasn't that that upset me. It was just how it didn't look like home. It was somewhere else. It wasn't home at all.
It turned out nobody back home much cared about his quest to carry Iraq's flag in the Winter Games. People were struggling just to survive. Faisal went back to college in Australia and says his life kind of fell apart.
For a whole year, I was at a very difficult place. It was really hard to comprehend what was going on.
Faisal was broke and depressed, and for more than a year he gave up skeleton racing. But the amazing part of his story is that it didn't end there.
Track is clear to start one for Faisal.
Earlier this week, I caught up with Faisal again at the top of the sled track in Lake Placid. Dressed in tattered racing tights, he hurled himself onto the ice using a secondhand sled wrapped in black duct tape.
So, let me track.
In 2008, Faisal slowly clawed his way back into the sport. No longer sponsored by the American team, ignored by Iraq's Olympic Committee, and pretty much forgotten by the media, Faisal is trying again.
This season, I made a lot of sacrifices, and my family has also, especially my family. I mean, my parents have made a real big financial sacrifice.
Hoping to qualify for Vancouver, Faisal hired independent sled coach Brian McDonald, who used to run a skeleton racing development program in Park City, Utah.
And he took some time off after 06, which kind of hurt him because when he came back this year, every time he's on the sled, there's pressure to do well. And that kind of impedes the learning curve of a slider. So he's got a big job ahead of him to make the games. It's possible, but it is pretty tough from this point out.
The big difference this year is that Faisal is a solid sledder. Not brilliant, not world-class, but respectable. What hasn't changed is that Faisal still sees his effort as a political act, a statement of hope. He reminded me of our first conversation back in 2005.
I said at the time I wanted to fight for my country. And you specifically asked me, what do you mean by fight for your country? And I explained that there was a war going on. There was nothing that I felt that I could do. And so I had to fight in a positive way.
Faisal has just three more chances to qualify for Vancouver, racing this weekend in Lake Placid, and again later this month in Calgary. If he succeeds, he'll make history for Iraq and maybe earn some recognition in his country. If he doesn't, he'll go back to Baghdad, still unknown, but hoping that this time it feels more like home and less like a war zone. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Pre-plan your getaway route. That's the lesson aspiring burglars can take from the experience of 20-year-old Jamario Hill and his two younger accomplices. Fleeing sheriff's deputies in Sacramento County after their alleged burglary, the masterminds ran onto a high school football field, which might have worked if two teams made up of police officers and firefighters hadn't been there practicing for a charity game. A crowd of defenders gang-tackled Mr. Hill, while an offensive line made up of officers chased and then brought down another suspect. The third was captured in the open field by a single deputy, doubtless a defensive back. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, America's top ice dancers, Belbin and Augusto, prepare for the 2010 Winter Olympics. But first, here to discuss ice dancing of a different sort. Yeah, full contact ice dancing there is Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Hi, Helene.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. We usually talk NHL with you, which I think we will do a bit later on. But I'd like to start with Olympic hockey, which you've been covering recently, Team Canada's roster was announced last week. I'd have thought that our neighbors north of the border would have gotten a little more excited about the team, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it almost went by like it never happened, just so much under the radar. And if you believe that, I swear that was just an incredible thing. The show that they put on when they were announcing the team, it was as dramatic as the Oscars and probably got higher ratings.
The roster of Team USA was announced at last week's Winter Classic right here at Fenway Park. It doesn't seem to have the same level of star power as Canada's roster has. Do you expect that squad to be competitive?
Absolutely, but a different kind of competitive. I think that when they put the team together, they realized that what they call their greatest generation, the Mike Modanos and Keith Kachuks and Bill Guerins, are kind of past their peak now. They went with a lot of youth. They went with grit. And I think what they're hoping for is just to cling by their fingernails and hope that Ryan Miller stops 52 shots a night, if that's what it takes.
There are also National Hockey League players on the rosters of teams from Switzerland, Russia, Norway, Latvia, Finland, Belarus, Sweden, Germany, and the Czech Republic and Slovakia, but not as many. Will any of those teams make strong medal runs?
Probably not. I think Switzerland's only chance is the goaltending, and they have Jonas Hiller of the Ducks, who will be one of their mainstays, and that's their best hope, is also just to hope that they can win some game 1-0 and get lucky some night. The point that a lot of people make is that this is going to be played on NHL-sized ice instead of international-sized ice, and that could be maybe possibly a little bit of an advantage to teams like Canada and the U.S. and Sweden that have a lot of players who play in the NHL. You know, Russia took a bunch of players from the Continental Hockey League. It's the new domestic league, and play a team like Norway, for example, or Switzerland, most of their players are playing in Europe and playing on the bigger ice, so they may have a little bit more of an adjustment problem, but I don't think it's going to be that much of a factor this time.
In women's Olympic ice hockey, it's pretty much the same list of national teams as on the men's side, minus Norway, Latvia, Belarus, Germany, and the Czech Republic.
Just that little detail.
A little change. But China will be represented in the women's tourney. What expectations are there, if any, for them?
Double digits goal against. It would be my guess. You know, I applaud them, and I didn't realize that they had enough support and enough women who would play the sport to be able to field a team, frankly. And that's the case, though, with a lot of these nations. I mean, once you get past the U.S. and Canada and Sweden and maybe Finland, it's really difficult. There's still a lot of cultural barriers, and there's still a lot of places where women's hockey doesn't get support.
Haley Wickenheiser was named captain of Canada's women's team. Can she lead them to a third straight Olympic gold medal?
I would think that that's a fairly good bet. They put a lot of effort into their program. They put a lot of money into their program. And being in Canada, there's a lot of pressure on them, but they've had a lot of time to build up a program. And believe me, this is a huge matter of national pride for them, and I would not be surprised to see them win.
Well, national pride notwithstanding, shouldn't Ms. Wickenheiser have found a real job by now? I mean, she's been on that team for about 50 years.
Now.
I'm just bitter because she beats the U.S. so often.
And because she skates better than you. Come on, let's be honest.
So does the chair that's sitting right across the table from me.
You know what? Good for her. She's pursuing her dream, and she's got some endorsements, and there's enough programs and support in place for her to do it. I mean, you know, you could say the same about Angela Ruggiero of the U.S. team. This is going to be her fourth Olympics. You know, good for her.
In the NHL, a quick glance at the standings reveals that the Phoenix Coyotes are having a pretty strong season, despite the possibility that the team will either be extradited to Ontario or left to rot in the desert. I'm not sure which. This must be a stalwart crew, huh?
Oh, I tell you, you cannot give them enough credit. Dave Tippett, their coach, has really held things together. And I think it also helps that there are a bunch of young guys, or predominantly young guys. And I suspect that as youngsters, there's fewer ties in terms of, you know, having kids in school or being tied to a certain area. And they may be less prone to give into the kind of rumors and pressure and stuff that's around them. I mean, they just go to the rink and play hockey. And I wish all of life were that simple.
The San Jose Sharks are among the NHL's top points winners. Should we ask you for the fifth straight season if they're for real, or should we just find a tape from a previous season and rerun it?
See, see previous, indeed. I'm not convinced about them yet. Sorry. I just saw the Kings last week beat them 6-2 pretty handily. They've had some flat spots. They've had a lot of great results, but do it in the playoffs. That's when men are men.
What are the other teams that you feel we should be mentioning at this stage of the NHL season, Helene?
The Chicago Blackhawks, I think, are really rounding out into a very imposing team. I mean, Brian Campbell has taken a lot of heat for having a big contract and not doing a whole lot, and even he has been playing well. Recently saw the Detroit Red Wings, and even though they keep losing players to injuries, they find ways to win. I mean, the other night they had this incredible 51-save performance from a rookie goalie, Jimmy Howard, and they're creeping back up into playoff contention. And, you know, once they get a couple guys back, I mean, that's a team that obviously knows how to win. And I would be very afraid of them if they get in the playoffs, which they will.
Helene Elliott covers ice hockey pro and Olympic for the LA Times, and she snowplows on in from time to time here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
For American figure skaters, the road to the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver goes through Spokane, Washington, where the U.S. Championships begin next Friday. That skating competition will help answer the questions of whether reigning men's world champion Evan Lysacek remains on track for an Olympic medal, and if anyone in the women's division even stands a chance of standing on the Olympic podium. But as Ron Schachter reports, America's best hope for an Olympic gold this year may rest at the feet of two ice dancers.
American audiences may know about Olympic ice dancing primarily from the sinuous and near-perfect performance to Ravel's Bolero, turned in by the British couple Torvald and Dean at the 1984 Olympics. Since ice dancing became an Olympic event in 1976, lesser-known Russian teams and one French duo have claimed all the other gold medals. American success has been hard to come by. But in a suburb outside of Philadelphia, the tune is changing. As Americans Tanith Belbin and Ben Augusto prepare for next week's U.S. Figure Skating Championships and for the February Olympics in Vancouver, with a legitimate chance of winning the United States' first gold medal in the event. That feat would follow their capture of America's first ever silver in the 2006 Olympics and a second-place finish in last year's World Championships. Belbin says those successes have helped change the perception of ice dancing in this country.
Even 10 years ago, I think that ice dancing seemed like the easy way out in skating or something. Like, if you can't jump, you dance. And that's not true at all. I could jump. I could do pairs. I chose dance, and I love it. And unlike the other disciplines where you can certainly identify that's a jump, that's a lift, that's a throw, ice dancing has the additional challenge of masking the difficulty within the performance and to know that you need to be able to handle the highest level of skill that skating can demand and make it look beautiful.
Ice dancing is not to be confused with pair skating, in which the competitors frequently separate to perform parallel jumps and spins. Ice dancers hold on to each other for almost the entire performance, a requirement for which the blonde Belbin and curly-haired, bearded Augusto are particularly well cut out, according to longtime TV skating commentator Dick Button.
And I think Belbin and Augusto are elegant, they're fluid, they are beautifully matched, they're beautifully constructed physically for both ice dancing and in relation to each other physically. He's dark, she's light. They're both tall, they're both elegant-looking skaters. They both have great energy, great push, and great style, and that's terribly important.
So is the increasingly acrobatic side of ice dancing, which has tended to pale next to the quadruple jumps and triple salchows of the singles competition. Belbin, who competed in singles and pairs before joining Augusto 12 years ago, is quick to point out that she and her partner match up physically with any other skaters.
In pair skating, taking the girl, lifting her straight up over your head and locking your elbows out is difficult, but there's a moment where it's just stable and it sticks and it stays and you know what you're doing, just like a clean sweep press in weightlifting. In ice dancing, you know, Ben's got my body climbing and swirling all around him at all times, and anyone can imagine that lifting a weight close to your body and straight over your head is much easier than holding it out at arm's length away from you and swinging it around yourself while you're doing footwork on the ice underneath it.
In fact, a back injury to Augusto from just such a maneuver caused the duo to miss last year's U.S. Championships, although he recovered in time for their stellar showing at the Worlds. Button credits part of the belated rise in American ice dancing fortunes to the relatively recent arrival of coaches from Russia, many of them past champions who have imported the techniques, discipline, and artistry emphasized in their homeland.
Russia, which has always had a background of dance, including music, choreography, and all of the fine arts of dance and theater, which the United States has too, but the Soviet Union put money into it. And they hired the best from both their opera companies and their dance groups to come and help the skaters.
They're so organic. They're so natural.
On this morning at the Iceworks Skating Club, Belbin and Augusto practice under the critical gaze of Gennady Karpanasov and his wife Natalia Linichuk, the 1980 Olympic ice dancing champions.
Little bit more knee forward, little bit more knee forward, more.
Linichuk handles the choreography as her two American charges cover the hockey rink in barely a dozen smooth strides, swiveling their feet and shifting their hands balletically along the way. But their most dramatic move to date, Belbin and Augusto agree, was from Michigan to Pennsylvania a year and a half ago when they left another Russian coach to work with Linichuk and Karpanasov.
Our decision to come to Natalia and Gennady was based on the fact that we knew that they had a track record of taking people and bringing them to that last final summit that they needed to make. And so we felt like we were, you know, at the final base camp before the summit of the mountain, but we didn't have a guide to take us there, and that's what we needed.
And this is at a point where we mentally were thinking, God, we're almost at the end, and we're disappointed. That's a terrible feeling, to be at the end of your career and not be satisfied. And they told us, you're just at the beginning, and that was exactly what we needed to hear, to believe that, okay, it's okay to start all over again. It's okay to feel like I don't have what it takes right now, but I will.
Open. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, sit, outside, inside, that's better, yeah.
Coming to Philadelphia has also meant coming skate to skate with the competition. The two Russian coaches also train Russian ice dancers Oksana Domnina and Maxim Shabalin, who edged Belbin and Augusto for the 2009 world title. It's an arrangement, says Karpanasov and Belbin, that works well.
Every day it's competition on the ice, but they're friendly. It's good. It's like sparring partner, you know, but very, very high level.
We'll get on the ice. We'll have a six-minute warm-up, just like at competitions. Natalia gives us a hat. We draw our starting order out of the hat. We sit on the bench, and we watch each other compete, and we compete every day.
The 27-year-old Augusto adds that he and his 24-year-old partner are happy to be blazing a trail on ice for younger American ice dancers, including Olympic medal contenders Merrill Davis and Charlie White, with whom they trained in Michigan.
What was once kind of the black sheep of figure skating has finally started to get the recognition that it deserves. And, you know, every year at our national championships, we see more and more young skaters. The junior ranks are just getting so much stronger and stronger, and these incredible young skaters are coming up. So I'm very excited for where we are now, but also for the future of the sport.
The immediate future of the sport may include an unprecedented American gold and possibly two medals in the Olympic ice dancing competition beginning on February 19th. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
You're listening to Only a Game. The crimes of once and perhaps future Washington Wizards guard Gilbert Arenas are multiple and dumb. He carried guns into a district where it is illegal to do so. He took said guns out of the box they were in while he and at least one of his Washington Wizards teammates, Javaris Crittenden, who may also have been armed and dangerous, were in the locker room. On Tuesday night in Philadelphia, as photographers snapped away, he made shooting gestures with his hands, indicating that he didn't think crimes 1 and 2 were serious. His bosses didn't agree, and now Gilbert Arenas has been suspended. Should he have known better? Of course he should have. Anybody who owns a gun should be aware of the various statutes regarding the display and transportation of same, whether the rules have been made by the federal government, the District of Columbia, or one's employer. Maybe anyone who owns, transports, and shows off four guns, as Arenas did, should be four times as aware of those rules and regulations as someone who owns, transports, and shows off only one. Over the past few years, pro athletes and ex-pro athletes have been known to discharge guns, registered and otherwise, into themselves or their associates, fire guns into the air, carry guns loaded and otherwise in their vehicles, and attempt to board airplanes while armed. This puts them in the company of a great many other citizens who are not pro or ex-pro athletes. It might be argued quite convincingly that we are a country of gun-toting, gun-displaying, gun-loving, gun-collecting, and gun-discharging, not to mention gun-selling people. A country in which the argument that more guns in the hands of more people would reduce gun use is as likely to produce solemn nods of agreement as peals of laughter. Should we expect more of our pro and ex-pro athletes than we do of members of the population at large? Though it's pleasant to suppose that to whom much has been given, much should be expected, probably not. Giving a young man millions of dollars does not make him smarter. It just makes him able to buy more stuff, which in some cases is likely to include more guns. None of this is to suggest that Gilbert Arenas isn't responsible for his stupid criminal acts. He is, and by now, even he may know it. Having been suspended, he's paying part of the price for what he's done, which includes over $147,000 per game for as long as the suspension lasts, and darker days are likely to follow. But to consider Arenas and his acts outside the context of his colleagues and the wider culture of our armed and dangerous country would be nearly as criminally stupid as what Gilbert Arenas has done. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been a hard go recently for Michael Owen. The 30-year-old Manchester United striker has not been playing regularly, and though he has scored 40 goals for England, the current coach, Fabio Capello, may not choose to bring him to South Africa for the World Cup. Jeff Boycott thinks the answer to Owen's miseries might be feng shui, the ancient Chinese art of placement. Boycott, a former cricketer for England, says he got into feng shui while being treated for cancer. I slept in different rooms, facing different ways, and it worked for me. I'm alive, he said recently. I wrote Michael Owen a while back to say, take a look at this and see what you think. I've seen him play, and he needs that little spark which maybe this can give him. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Alabama's history of claiming to be number one more often than fans of other teams think that's been the case. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Alabama took home its 13th championship Thursday night, or maybe its 7th or 8th or something.
Fourth.
In either case, were you surprised by the result?
No, I was surprised by how the result evolved as the game went on. I didn't expect Colt McCoy to play five plays. I didn't expect Alabama to go into a shell. I didn't expect Nick Saban to lose his mind and fake a punt on 4th and 23. I didn't expect Mack Brown to call and raise stupidity by having his rookie quarterback with 15 minutes of BCS experience trying to throw a shovel pass before halftime. But I think the best team in the country won the game.
Charlie, we spoke last week about guns being drawn in an argument in the Washington Wizards locker room. Gilbert Arenas, who apparently brought four unloaded pistols into his place of business, did not seem inclined to take that story seriously, but now he's been suspended indefinitely by Commissioner Stern, which I assume he will have to take seriously.
Well, he'll have to take it seriously because they're not going to let him into the arena with his uniform anytime soon. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with Javaris Crittenden, the other gunslinger in the play. But Arenas has also started acting a little bit unstrung as this story has begun to unfold, so we'll have to keep an eye on what happens to him.
Eight teams play in the National Football League's wild card weekend. Only four will make it to next week's divisional round. Who's got your hypothetical for entertainment purposes only bet?
Well, the really interesting thing here, of course, is a lot of these games are repeats of games that were played last week.
Absolutely true.
Including Dallas and Philadelphia, and I think that one's going to be reversed. I like the Philadelphia Eagles. I think they beat Dallas, and I think they may go to the Super Bowl. Elsewhere, I don't think Baltimore can muster up enough offense to beat the Patriots. I like Green Bay. I think they will play Philadelphia in the NFC Championship game. Aaron Rodgers is the breakthrough player for me in this NFL season. And the Bengals and the Jets, I truly could care less.
The Washington Racial Slurs announced the hiring of a new head coach this week, Mike Shanahan. He immediately promised the team's fans that he would not disappoint them. So, can he keep that promise?
Yes, because there's no way he can. If he has a pulse and is remotely lifelike on the sidelines and they win four games, things will be looking up in Washington.
Among the coaches looking for work today is the University of South Florida's Jim Leavitt. Leavitt and his staff were let go yesterday after a player's father alleged that his son was grabbed and struck by the coach. Do you think coaches will soon get the memo that bullying is not perhaps the proper form of motivation if you wish to hold on to your job?
Baby steps, Bill. Baby steps. Physical assault is not the way to hold on to your job. They'll evolve gradually to become less rigid and authoritarian.
The University of Michigan made a change this week. The new athletic director there has experience in politics and in pizza. Are you surprised at the appointment of former Domino's CEO David Brandon?
No, because the athletic director at Michigan is a CEO. He's also a CFO more than he's an athletic director. He was making $3.2 million as the CEO at Domino's, which is a lot of pizza, by the way. We know they'll eat well now. And you know what?
Or at least fast.
And you know what? If Michigan doesn't score a touchdown in the first half hour of next season, everybody gets into the next game for free.
Okay, all those baseball players who will be welcomed into the Hall of Fame this summer, please take two steps forward.
And not so fast there, Blylevin.
Mr. Blylevin and Mr. Alomar, not so fast. Are you surprised those two won't be joining Andre Dawson as inductees?
I'm utterly shocked on Alomar because every baseball writer I talked to said he was the lock of the class. And something is going on with Blylevin. I keep being told that he came really close this year. If he didn't get it this year, there's something going on beyond the usual foolishness of this balloting. I'm happy for Andre Dawson, though.
There is reason to anticipate that Tony La Russa's St. Louis Cardinals will be contenders in 2010. They have pitching and they have Albert Pujols. But this week, manager La Russa suggested that if his team is in the pennant race, he might suit up his batting coach as a pinch hitter. So, any reason that might be a problem?
The problem is going to be, of course, that this could be pure electioneering on the part of La Russa trying to buy McGuire a few more years in the Hall of Fame ballot. McGuire got 23.7% of the votes this year. It was 21.9 last year. Apparently, La Russa's perceiving a trend. If he plays, that starts the clock again, of course, in his retirement. I can't see Mark McGuire ever getting more than 40% of the vote, let alone 75.
I can't see him coming out of this long a retirement and trying to hit a major league fastball.
Well, I can see him coming out of this long a retirement, hitting a major league fastball, and then everybody assuming he's taking drugs. That's what I can see.
Pitcher Randy Johnson, late of lots of major league teams, announced his retirement this week. When was the last time the retirement of a 46-year-old baseball player made the news?
I presume Nolan Ryan, to whom Randy Johnson's 4,875 strikeouts ranks second. I don't want to get into this endless fight about the Hall of Fame, about who should be a first-ballot Hall of Famer and who shouldn't. Randy Johnson should be a first-ballot Hall of Famer.
Charlie, Major League Soccer's basic agreement expires in 3 weeks. Attempts to negotiate a new agreement have not gone well. Is that a smile I see?
No, I don't want the MLS to go out of business. That's crazy. I didn't realize, for example, till now, that soccer players have an international union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're fighting again against the limitations of their niche. And I think I would hope management would find a way to be fair, and I hope players would realize that a niche sport is a niche sport.
A little later this year, we will be able to watch sports on TV in 3D, assuming that we've purchased the appropriate machinery. ESPN has announced that at least 85 sporting events will be shown in 3D this year, starting with the first game of the World Cup in June. So, will this change everything in the Pierce household?
Well, I don't know about you, Bill, but I can't keep those red and blue glasses on my nose over my regular glasses. I tried in the movies all those years ago. It doesn't work. I don't know. Do I want my sports in 3D? I kind of prefer my sports in 2D. But surprising as it may be to you, I don't want to see soccer in no D.
Wait a minute. That was at least a double negative.
It was a triple. I know. It was a confusing triple negative.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
To learn more about the books we feature or the music you hear on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. On Thursday night, Alabama knocked over Texas 37-21, thereby winning the game that determined college football's national champion. The occasion marked the 13th time Alabama had assumed that position, at least according to Kenneth Gaddy. He is the editor of 12 and Counting, the National Championships of Alabama Football, and he joined me yesterday from Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa. When we spoke, I began by suggesting that somebody was going to have to go around with a bunch of stickers that said 13 to put them over the 12 on the cover of 12 and Counting.
You know, we were talking about that yesterday afternoon. You know, what if? That was before the game was played, obviously. Yeah, we'll have to come up with something for the fall, perhaps, and add a 13th chapter, maybe do a paperback version or something like that. But, you know, that's a good problem to have.
Championship number one came in 1925, long enough ago so that the team's best tackler, Pooley Hubert, who was also a force on offense, did not wear a helmet. Even in 1925, most of the players wore helmets. I know you didn't write this essay yourself, but do you know why Pooley Hubert didn't?
Well, you know, he just thought it wasn't manly to wear a helmet. He had gone into the service, served in World War I. And when he got out of the service, he'd come back to school. So he was kind of the old man of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And when your first name is Allison, you got to be a tough guy.
And so he went with Pooley. Come on.
That's right.
Why not Spike or Stud?
Yeah, that was an unusual team. Just about everybody on that team had a nickname of one type or another.
The governor of Alabama in 1925 was Bill Brandon, and he praised the football team for, quote, improving the national image of the state and the South. What was his reasoning there?
Well, you got to remember, this is not that long after the Civil War. You know, Reconstruction in some people's mind was still going on, so it was a pretty depressed time. You know, economically, things were tough. So not only did they win a football game, but, you know, they brought the state up to a level of recognition and respect that it had not experienced perhaps ever. You know, that's one of the things that has been a part of the tradition here, and perhaps why it's so important is that victory helped establish Southern football. You know, the Rose Bowl was the bowl game, the only bowl game,
mm-hmm.
and a Southern team had never played in it. So it was important not just to Alabama, but to all the teams in the South. If they had lost that game, it may have taken much longer, if ever, to establish football in the South.
The 1930 team was also national champion, and the yearbook referred to that team as, quote, champions of the universe. That would seem a little extreme even by college yearbook standards, don't you think?
Well, that's written by a college student, so maybe it was their universe. But that was another special team. You know, Coach Wade, that was his last year as the Alabama coach. And he had a running battle with George Denny, the university president, who had hired him. But Dr. Denny was very demanding and very controlling. He would go to every practice. And they had a little tradition. It was good luck if Dr. Denny got knocked down at practice. And he just about every practice, he would get tumbled over several times. Wade had actually resigned before that season started.
Mm.
and they had hired Coach Thomas at the recommendation of Wade, and he actually went on that Rose Bowl trip. So on that January 1, 1931, the day of the Rose Bowl, Alabama actually had two head coaches, even though Wade was in charge and Thomas was in the stands.
A Nashville sports writer, one Blinky Horn, said of Vanderbilt's defeat by Alabama in 1930 that Vanderbilt was, quote, pulverized by power, struck down by strength, swept aside by speed, and crushed by cohesion. These red men are roguish people, he wrote. They strike with venom. Great days for sports writing, don't you think?
Yeah, that's one of the great things to do is we have scrapbooks at the museum of all these years, starting with even in the teens, but certainly from the 25 season forward. So you can go back and read this in the language and that they used like you just read. It's very colorful, and you got to remember there's no radio, no TV. So that's the single source of information. And they really are a lot of fun to read.
Wouldn't it be great if instead of being known as the Crimson Tide, Alabama football teams were now known as the Roguish People?
Well, I don't know if they would go for that one, but, you know, Crimson Tide is one of those things that just kind of happened. It wasn't something that they sat down and planned out. A sports writer, as we're talking about sports writers, had used that in a column, mm-hmm. and it just kind of stuck. And one of those things that kind of built over time. You know, before that, you know, originally I'm known as the crimson and white, which are the colors, and then later the thin red line, which is kind of a World War I reference. And, you know, that gives you the influence of sports writers that, you know, Crimson Tide kind of grew out of an article.
Now, Mr. Gatti, I don't want to be a killjoy, but I think it's only fair to point out that it's a little bit arbitrary to say that before Thursday night, Alabama had won 12 national championships, because according to some counts, it's 10, maybe as few as 9, just because over the years, there has really been no consistent way to determine the national champion. You say 12. How did you come up with that number?
Well, for every sport other than football, there is an awarded national championship by the NCAA. They do not award a national championship in football, and they never have. So they always rely on the wire services and those kind of groups to award them. Well, people say you got to start with the AP. Well, that didn't start until 36. Can you count UPI? UPI doesn't exist anymore. People think of USA Today. Well, that started in 1982. So, you know, there really is, you know, five more that we might could have added to that list. But the university recognizes yesterday was 12, today 13.
That is the most spectacularly convoluted explanation of a statistical operation that I've ever heard.
Well, and they probably could have gone for this whole interview discussing the system.
We should recognize that all years have not been great years for Alabama football. Before Paul Bryant took over the team in 1958, there were several years during which the players were, according to your book here, undisciplined and disheartened, and an aura of failure loomed about them. This is from Chapter 6 of the book. What do you suppose it was like being a student at Alabama when the football team stunk?
Well, it probably wouldn't have been a pleasant place to be. And that's one of the reasons Coach Bryant came back. You know, he is famously quoted saying one of the reasons he took the job in 1958 is Mama called. You know, he was a player here, an assistant coach. He was a member of a national championship team. So he had some connection and some feel of the importance of his time here on campus. But you're right, those mid-50s years were not spectacular.
Winston Groom, writing about Paul Bryant in 12 and Counting, says that the decision to hire him, quote, turned out to be the best deal the University of Alabama ever made. Does that seem a reasonable judgment to you?
Well, I think that's very reasonable. Coach Bryant always said that he didn't want to get paid more than the university president, and he stuck to that. And the value that you can assign to Coach Bryant's name, I don't think can be calculated. I mean, you know, I can look out. I work at the Bryant Museum, which is on Bryant Drive, just down the road from Bryant-Denny Stadium, which is right over my shoulder right now. The Academic Center for the Players is Bryant Hall. If you'd watched the game last night, you would have seen several people wearing houndstooth. The cachet value of Coach Bryant, you know, I've had people tell me, you know, 20 years ago it wouldn't last. Well, it may be as big now as it was 20 years ago.
Let's close on another contemporary note. What does last night's win mean to this year's football players and other students at Alabama?
Well, you know, I think just seeing the excitement after the game there and, you know, seeing some tears in some of the guys' eyes, you know, it's a work. I mean, I think it's the effort that you put into it, you know, the plan it takes to pull all that together. It's been very impressive in it's kind of reminiscent of Coach Bryant, if you will, you know, to go through all that planning and all that work, the physical, the mental that it takes to do. I think they should be very proud of themselves, and I think us fans certainly are proud of them.
Kenneth Gaddy is the editor of 12 and Counting, the National Championships of Alabama Football, published, perhaps not surprisingly, by the University of Alabama Press. He joined me from Alabama Public Radio in Tuscaloosa. Mr. Gaddy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Brian Polnitz at Alabama Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, learn more about our weekly music selections, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from 12 and Counting editor Kenneth Gaddy.
Pretty good day to be an Alabama fan.
You think? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.